John chapter 5. You might have seen, many of you, the syllabus on the communication table that I was telling you before that would be there, and that, of course, is on 1 Corinthians. So, Sunday, we'll begin our study of 1 Corinthians, and that is, of course, a wonderful book, a great book, and different. All the books of the Bible, obviously, are great, wonderful, all inspired. And they all have their own characteristics. The book of Romans, for example, as we've preached through here a little while ago, is a great book because it deals with God's plan of salvation, the just shall live by faith. 1 Corinthians is great from another standpoint. It is valuable to us some ways, sadly, because of all of the missteps that the Corinthians took. That the Corinthians were, of course, carnal-minded, and Paul rebuked them for that, suing one another in court of law, had all kind of problems with division and that sort of thing. But all of that helps us to learn what not to do and what not to be. And, of course, the Corinthians, at least many of them, ultimately repented of that. We know from Paul's second letter to them. And so we praise God for that. But we do learn a lot of the things that we shouldn't want to do and shouldn't want to be by studying that book. And so we'll go through that, and hopefully you have, if you haven't picked up a syllabus there on the communication table, remember those are put together by man, and so if just let me know if half of your book is upside down, let me know about it, or if you got three page 20s or something like that, let me know, and I'll get you another one, or we'll correct that somehow. We'll be in the book, as we always are, for quite a long time, going verse by verse, and so I know that your books can get kind of raggedy and things. If you need a page replaced or something, just let me know. We'll do what we can about that. But we'll start that on Sunday morning. All right, John chapter 5. That's where we are in our Wednesday night study, if you're visiting with us. Good to have the Bonds here tonight, if you haven't seen them yet. And always good, very good friends of this local congregation, of course, and look forward to talking with him after service a little bit. Surprised me. I didn't know you were going to be here, brother. So good to have you. But anyway, John chapter 5, we've been emphasizing the fact that the main emphasis of John is the deity of Christ. And, of course, we'll continue to mention that because that's the thing that he is emphasizing more so than the other Gospels. Now, you see that in all of the Gospels. But John seems to have a special emphasis upon that. And that is something that, again, is a part of our confession of faith, that Jesus wasn't just a man, he wasn't just a prophet, wasn't just a religious man, but that he is God manifested in the flesh. If you turn over to 1 Timothy very quickly, you see, of course, the familiar words of Paul, 1 Timothy chapter 3, and at verse 15, Paul writes, "But if I delay, you may know how one ought to behave in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, a pillar and a buttress of truth. Great indeed, we confess, is the mystery of godliness." Now watch, he says, he was manifested in the flesh. He who, that points up to the God under consideration here, the living God, who, of course, it says the church of the living God. We know the church belongs to Christ. Acts 20, verse 28, he purchased the church with his own blood. And so the God under consideration here is Jesus. He's the one who was manifested in the flesh. And even as you read this description, you know this is referring to the Son, not the Father. It was Jesus who was vindicated by the Spirit. It was Jesus who was seen by the angels, proclaimed among the nations, believed on in the world, and of course taken up into glory, referring to his ascension. And so this God manifested in the flesh is Jesus. And that's what John deals with as he begins the book of John in John 1 and at verse 1, that the Word was God. The Word was with God and the Word was God. And so this is what John is emphasizing throughout his book, and we'll continue to mention that week to week, that is his emphasis. Now, we closed off last week. We were talking about these two resurrections, John chapter 5, and we made our way down to verse 25, and going down to verse 29, and we said that there are two resurrections there under consideration, the spiritual one and the physical one. And, of course, the one of first importance is the spiritual one. And he's describing there being quickened or made alive from a spiritual standpoint. Truly, truly, I say unto you that an hour is coming and now is here when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God and those who hear will live. And so that's dealing with spiritual life. Everybody should want to hear the words of Jesus and be saved. And then down at verse 28, we get into that second resurrection that he's talking about. And we said that this is a bodily resurrection. It says, do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice. You notice he didn't say anything about tombs in the first resurrection that he talked about, because it's spiritual, not physical. But this is a bodily resurrection. That is, again, another cornerstone of our faith as Christians, that one of these days we're going to be raised from the dead. A bodily resurrection. This body is going to be raised up. The great passage, of course, on that is 1 Corinthians chapter 15, but there are many others that speak of that time when this body is going to be raised from the dead. It's going to be changed. It's going to be incorruptible instead of corruptible. It's going to be raised in power instead of weakness, but it is going to be raised. And again, that's important. That's a foundation of our faith, a bodily resurrection. We'll deal with that, by the way, several months from now when we get to it, the end of the book of 1 Corinthians. But that's what he's describing here at verse 28, that bodily resurrection. Now, you notice again, verse 29 says, all in the tombs, again, will hear his voice and will come out, those who have done good to the resurrection of life and those who have done evil unto the resurrection of judgment. And so we stated last week that there's only two groups of people. All of us here tonight fall into one of these two groups, either good or evil. And it's just that simple. There is no in between. There is no sort of good or kind of evil. We're all good or evil. Now, to look at that a little bit more detail with regard to, for example, the good, who make up the good? One of the things I've often pointed out, you might remember, I probably mentioned this when we went through the book of Romans, but in a lot of preaching I mentioned this, that the people of God can always be described the same way in every generation, in every dispensation. The people of God are the same. They're always those who have two things. They have faith in God and are faithful. And that's the people of God. Always. They always have been, always will be. Those who have faith in God and are faithful. In other words, you have to first trust in God and then be faithful to whatever instruction or commandments or law that you're under that he has set forth. And that was true in the days of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That was true once the law of Moses was ushered in and the Jews were separated from the Gentiles, those Jews under the Old Testament economy, who were the true people of God? Some say, well, all of those Jews. No, really, technically, that's not true. The true people of God, even in the Old Testament, were those who had faith in God and were faithful. Remember Romans chapter 9 at verse 6, not all of Israel is of Israel. And he's saying not all the physical descendants of Abraham, not all the physical Israelites are truly Israelites, are spiritual Israel. Who's spiritual Israel? Well, those who have faith in God and are faithful. So when Jesus died on the cross, then his blood flowed backwards and cleansed the folks under the Old Testament. But what folks under the Old Testament? Did the blood of Jesus Christ cover everyone who lived in Old Testament times? No. It cleansed those who had faith in God and were faithful. They weren't perfect. Remember the old law, the law of Moses, was a law, as we've pointed out many times, that was sort of a legalistic law that made no provision for sin. The sacrifices, the blood of bulls and goats, the Hebrew writer in Hebrews 10 tells us they won't do. They can't take away sins in an absolute sense. And so those people back then, Abraham, Adam, everybody back then, they all needed Jesus as much as you do, as much as I do. And do you remember, of course, from Hebrews chapter 9, flip over there just for a moment. In Hebrews chapter 9, the Hebrew writer informs us that they were cleansed, those folks back there, were cleansed by Jesus just like we are. Hebrews chapter 9 and at verse 15, it says, verse 14 says, how much more would the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purified our consciences from dead works to serve the living God? Therefore, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance. Since a death has occurred, what death? Certainly not the death of the bulls and goats, but the death of our Savior, Jesus Christ. A death has occurred, now listen to this, that redeems them from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. See that? That's how powerful the blood of Christ is. So that the blood of Christ cleansed even those Old Testament saints. But again, what Old Testament saints? Not every saint that lived back then, but those who had faith in God and were faithful. So now then we move into this dispensation. Who are the people of God today? The true people of God. Those who have faith in God and are faithful. And those are the ones who are described back in John chapter 5. Those are the ones who do good and who are going to be resurrected unto life. Not every religious person. It's not everyone who claims to believe in Jesus. Listen to me now. It's not every member of the Church of Christ. It's people who have faith in God and are faithful. And you have to ask yourself the question, and so do I, do I fall into that category? I have faith in God, I know that. But am I walking according to the vocation wherewith I've been called? As Paul talks about in Ephesians 4:1. Am I obeying God? Now, do I have to be perfect? No. This good here is not referring to those who live perfect lives, because none of us do that. We all sin and fall short of the glory of God. So we need the grace of God. But in this dispensation, if we're faithful, if we live to the very best of our ability according to the gospel of Christ, and we sin, we repent of that and ask God for forgiveness and so on and so forth, then we fall into this category of good. And so that's what you want to be. Good according to the stipulations of the gospel, in other words. You don't deserve anything. I don't deserve anything. We're not good from that standpoint. But if we live by the gospel, having faith in God and are faithful, then we'll go to heaven after a while. Remember Revelation 2 and at verse 10, what did Jesus say to those people? Be faithful unto death. And that's what we have to do. We have to be faithful unto death. Have to have faith in God and be faithful unto death, and we'll receive that crown of life. And so we'll be raised unto life. The other group, of course, are those who don't have faith in God or who might have mental assent, but they're not living faithfully. Again, the Jews in the Old Testament, God's people who were specially set aside from all of the Gentiles, the majority of them, if you asked them if they believed in God, they'd all tell you yes. But they weren't very faithful. Just a casual reading through the Old Testament, you find that many, many of them went after false gods and that sort of thing and lived immoral lives because of that. But now again, if you asked them, we believe in God. But they weren't faithful. And that's why they ended up going off into captivity. But those folks who weren't faithful back then, the blood of Christ can't do a thing for them. And the blood of Christ can't do a thing for you. If you're not faithful, and if you're not faithful unto death. 1 Corinthians 15 at verse 58, remember what Paul said there? He begged them to be steadfast, unmovable, always doing what? Always abounding in the work of the Lord. Why? So that you know your labor is not in vain. And so there's going to be a resurrection. There's no question about that. One of these days, every tomb is going to be opened and everybody's going to be raised either to life or judgment. We want to be raised unto life. Okay, down to verse 30 then. Jesus knows and all that he has said, going back really to verse 17, since the Jews confronted him. And you remember how all of this got going. He has healed an individual who had been crippled for 38 years. But when did he do it? He did it on the Sabbath. That caused a big ruckus with the Jews, of course. They are all upset about that, which verifies a statement that Jesus is later going to make in this very chapter, and that is that they didn't have the love of God in them. And there's no doubt about that. Their reaction to this man being healed is evidence of their utter lack of love. All they can think about, this poor man who hadn't walked in 38 years, is now made whole, and everybody should be rejoicing over that, but all they want to know is who did that to you on the Sabbath? And that's how all this got started. And so as Jesus begins a conversation with them, he has told them many things that would affirm his deity. What was the first thing? What was the first thing he said that you know he is God? Now, you know I like to review, so don't give me. What was the first thing he said back around verse 17? What made the Jews say it again? My Father. He referred to God as his Father. And right away, the Jews, they started to forget about the Sabbath business. They thought, oh, this man is blaspheming. He's making himself equal with God. Why? Because he referred to God as his Father. And I've made the point to you, you just keep that in mind. Every time Jesus refers to God as his Father, that is an affirmation of his deity. It means they're the same kind of being. Because we're children of God, how? By what? By adoption. Jesus is the only begotten Son of God. So when it says he's equal with God, he is in a submissive role now in his scheme of redemption. It's not talking about authority, but from the standpoint of being the same kind of being, if God is his Father, they're the same kind of being. See, I've made the point before. You all, but it doesn't work with many of you because you know my son Jordan. But if you have never seen Jordan again, I told you Jordan's my son. What would you conclude he was? A dog? You think I have a son. His name Jordan. Oh, he must be an alligator. Where do you know Jordan is? He's my son. He's a human being, isn't he? He's the same kind of being as me, because that's just the laws of God from the beginning. Seed produces after its kind. And so the point of it is, that's what the Jews thought immediately when Jesus said that God is his Father. When he referred to God as his Father, they right away knew he's claiming equality with God. And what didn't Jesus do? He knew their thoughts. He knew their words. What didn't he do? He never denied it. He had a lot against these Jews, but that wasn't one of them. He never went to them and said, now, you're misrepresenting me. I never claimed equality with God. He knew that was exactly what he was doing. That's what he meant to do. That was his plan. And because he knew who he was, he's God, manifested in the flesh. And so he's affirming his deity. But that he was just getting started there. When he talked about being the judge, when he talked about having life in his power, when he talked about the Son receiving the same honor as the Father, all of those things, each one of them were affirmations of his deity. And so Jesus knows what he's doing. Yeah, go ahead. I'll get the Son and then the Father. Yes.
So if it were not so, he would have told those Jews.
Yes.
If they're thinking that, there's no guile in his mouth. I like that statement. I like that thought. Because going back to that, Jesus, there was nothing deceiving about Jesus at all.
No, that's right.
If it were not so, I would have told him.
Yes.
He would have done that with anything.
Yes, and there were times when he did. You know, when the Jews were going down the wrong track and misrepresenting him, Jesus would hesitate to point it out. But this wasn't one of them. He didn't point out because they weren't misrepresenting him. He was claiming equality with God. Yeah, good.
I was thinking about, you were talking about all authority, that he is God, and he's always claimed that because he's always been. Even in the Great Commission in Matthew 28, mm-hmm. he said, all authority has been given me in heaven and earth,
yes.
which makes him deity and equality with God.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Very good. Very good. So all of these things. Now, one thing Jesus knows is that these Jews aren't just going to take his word for it. So again, I bring up these past verses for a reason, and that is just to put in our mind, Jesus have made all of these affirmations. But he knows the Jews aren't going to just now all of a sudden say, all right, let's forget about what you did on the Sabbath and all this. Do we believe you now? No, he knows he's not. So what he does in the next several verses, he begins to bring up witnesses that testify that he is who and what he claims to be. And so at verse 30, just to get it started, he says, I can do nothing on my own. As I heard, I judge. And my judgment is just because I seek not my own will, but the will of him who sent me. So now he's going to get into naming specific witnesses. But here he just, to begin it, he says, I do nothing on my own. You don't like what he's doing? You take that up with the Father. Jesus didn't do anything all by himself. He, again, when he came here to this earth, he came in a role of submission. He came in the role of a son. And everything he did during his personal ministry, everything he said, he received from the Father. And that's something that John really emphasizes over and over. Look over in John chapter 8 and at verse 26. Listen to this. John chapter 8 at verse 26. Jesus says, I have much to say about you and much to judge, but he who sent me is true. And I declare to the world that I have heard from him. Now stop and think about that. First of all, he talks about the one who sent him. Who sent him? God. You know what that makes Jesus? Jesus was an apostle. He was? Yeah, he was an apostle. How many sermons have you heard? I've preached many of them here. When we break down that word apostle, it means to be sent forth. I often give the illustration. If I sent you to go get a glass of water, if I said, James, go get me a glass of water, and James went and got a glass of water, you know what that would make him? He'd be an apostle of Don Wright. Now, what does that make him? Well, who said that? Because I don't have any authority, do I? I'm nobody. That'd make him nobody. Now, the apostles of Christ, they were important because of the one who did the sending. They were sent forth by Christ. Well, Jesus was sent forth by God. So he was in fact, turn over to Hebrews chapter 3. You remember what the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews, the third chapter? Hebrews chapter 3 and at verse 1. It says, therefore, holy brethren, you who share in a heavenly calling, consider Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession. See there? Jesus is an apostle. He's one who was set forth. And who sent him forth? The Father. So the point of it is, when Jesus was sent forth to this earth, he's under the commission of the Father. And everything he did was in accordance with the Father's will. He was fulfilling his mission. He was doing the work of God. Everything that he said, he heard from the Father. Again, in John chapter 8 at verse 26 then, he says, what I have heard from him. Look at verse 40. He says, but now you seek to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. John's always using language like that. Look at John chapter 15. In John chapter 15 at verse 15. John 15 at verse 15. He says, no longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends. Why? For all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. So over and over. He's always talking. Jesus is constantly talking about what he heard from the Father. And look, I'll tell you another passage that's real familiar. John chapter 12. And John 12, verse 48. You're familiar with this. The one who rejects me does not receive my words as a judge. The word that I have spoken will judge him on the last day. For I have not spoken on my own authority, but the Father who sent me has himself given me a commandment, what I should say and what I should speak. That's the role that Jesus was in when he was here on earth. He's still in that role. He's still in that role of a redeemer. But the point of it is, so what is he saying then to the Jews? The Jews had all kind of negative things to say about Jesus and what he has done and what he has said. He said, listen, everything I've said, everything I've done comes from the Father. See, and he's going to be pointing out now they're rejecting him. In rejecting him, if everything he says and does comes to the Father, who are they really rejecting? They're rejecting the Father too. They don't want that. They wouldn't want to hear that. But that's the point that he's ultimately getting to. Well, verse 31 then, he says, if I alone bear witness about myself, my testimony is not true. There is another who bears witness about me, and I know that the testimony that he bears about me is true. Now there he is talking about the Father. That's the other one who bears witness. And that's very significant, but the Jews wouldn't believe that. You know, he says that to them because that's true. And he's going to emphasize that more down at verse 37 and going down into the text, that God bears witness of him. But do you think the Jews are going to hear that and believe that? No. So look at the next thing he says. He talks about that other one. That's the Father. But then at verse 33, he says, you sent to John and he has borne witness to the truth. Now, here's a witness. Here's someone who bears testimony that these Jews have to really take note of because of what has transpired already. John came on the scene and John was hugely popular. You remember all of Judea, I think it says in Matthew, came out to hear him, and he baptized hundreds, and he was a powerful preacher. He came in the spirit of Elijah, and so the Jews were flocking to him. Even the Pharisees came out to him. And so he brings up John, and watch what he says about him. At verse 34, he says, verse 32, another bear witness, you sent John, okay, the 33, 34, not that the testimony that I received from man, but I say these things so that ye might be saved. That was always his motive. Verse 35 is what I want. He was a burning and shining lamp. And you were willing to rejoice for a while in his light. Now, isn't that right? We studied through that a little bit. You remember that, don't you? When he came on the scene, again, he was hugely popular. John the Baptist, that is. He was hugely popular. But what was his constant, consistent testimony? He's not the Christ. Look back over just quickly. Look back over to John chapter 1 and just let's remind ourselves of what exactly John did. You know, this is a case, this happens a lot even today. There's a lot of people who fall in love with the preacher and they forget about what's preached. And that's why people get caught up in sometimes emotionalism, and they want a preacher who's going to run all around and turn circles and jump on pews and that sort of, and do all of that stuff, and then by the end of the day, you don't even know what he said. Some people love the preacher more than what's preached. And the evidence seems to be that a lot of these Jews, they were listening to John, and he was powerful. Again, he came in the spirit of Elijah. Jesus even called him that there was no man greater than him that has ever lived. And they were swept up into that. And Jesus is kind of, you know, knocking on their foreheads and saying, you remember what he taught? Remember this one who you loved so much and you rejoiced and got caught up in his burning light? You remember what he taught? He taught about me. He was testifying about me. And we know that. Look at John, John 1 and at verse 7. It says, he came as a witness to bear witness about the light that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. Who was that light he came to bear witness about? That was Jesus. Look down at verse 15. John bore witness about him and cried, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks before me.'" Why? Because he was before me. That's speaking of the eternal nature of Jesus. That strong testimony that John the Baptist gave. Down at verse 26, John answered them, "I baptize with water, but among you stands one you do not know. Even he who comes after me, the straps of whose sandals I'm not worthy to untie." And then down at verse 29, the next day, Jesus saw coming towards him and said, the next day he saw Jesus rather coming towards him and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world." You see the point? I mean, when you stop and go back and look at what John actually said, he was the forerunner of Christ. He bore strong testimony of Jesus, bore witness about him. And these Jews now whom Jesus is talking about, many of them were there. Like, did you forget what John testified? And so he has all these witnesses. I have the Father who bears witness of me. And God basically does that through the prophets and through the miracles that Jesus performed. But he says, I have John, who you sent people out to go see. And you rejoiced in him. And he testified of me. And then at verse 36, he says, "But the testimony that I have is greater than that of John. For the works that the Father has given me to accomplish, the very works that I am doing bear witness about me that the Father has sent me." So here's another strong witness. You have John the Baptist, who clearly testified and bore witness about Jesus. But he says, you know, at the end of the day, I don't really need John. You want to know the truth of it? All you have to do is look at my works and think about what we have seen so far in five chapters in the book of John. He has healed again, as we stated earlier, a man crippled who couldn't walk, been crippled for 38 years. He healed a boy who was dying of some disease. He was 20 miles away. All Jesus had to do was speak the word, and the same hour he was healed. That's the power of Jesus. He's turned water into wine. You think of all and many other things that John hasn't even mentioned. He's already, by this time in his personal ministry, he has healed the blind and done all kinds of things. And all of those works cry out, Jesus is who he says he is. In fact, what did Nicodemus say in John chapter 3? You remember? What did Nicodemus say? We know. Well, that's exactly right. We know that you're a teacher sent from God, because no one else could do these works unless God be with them. And notice, Nicodemus was a Pharisee, and he said, we who? He and the other Pharisees, the other leading Jew. We know this. And so his work, it's amazing to me that all of those Jews there and all of those who either saw firsthand or had credible the evidence that Jesus performed these kind of miracles, that every one of them didn't turn to Jesus Christ. But they didn't. And what we'll find going forward is that even those who did so for the wrong reason. They followed Jesus. Now listen, here's a lesson in this. A lot of people follow Jesus because of what he does for them, not because of who he is. And that's going to be the case with some of these, when we get into the next chapter. Yeah, Sam. Yes, and see, so you have at least two occasions there at his baptism and at his transfiguration where he received direct testimony from the Jews. Now, so far as we know, that there were probably not too many of these Jewish leaders were privy to that. He has received direct testimony from heaven that he is the Son of God. This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. But his miracles prove it. John the Baptist prove it. And when you stop and think about it, just even the teachings of Christ, he spoke as one who had authority. And there's so many things, but these Jews are denying it. And as we don't have time now, but we'll get into it. I think next week we'll get into it. that they really didn't believe. Here's another problem that we all have to address within our own hearts. There's a lot of people who think they believe in the Bible, but don't. They believe in something, but it's not really the Bible. They believe in the Bible per se, but what they really believe in is a misinterpretation of the Bible. And that was exactly what the Jews, if you asked any of those Jews, do you believe in Moses? They'd all instantly say yes and be mad that you even asked them about that. Do you believe in the law? Absolutely. But did they believe in Moses? They thought they did. They claimed to. But what they really believed in is a misinterpretation of the law of Moses. That's hard to talk somebody out. It's easier to give someone hope who doesn't have any hope than it is to convince someone who thinks they're right that they're wrong and they really don't have any hope. And so we'll get into all of that next week. Appreciate your attention.